It's my pleasure today to represent the Thomas Jefferson Foundation and introduce Mr. Kenneth Thompson, who is Burkitt Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. Thank you all for knowing. He is here to introduce our friend, Charles McDowell, who we all know.
We're always grateful, and especially on this occasion, for the hospitality of the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation. They've been immensely generous to the Miller Center, and we're deeply appreciative. Some choices are hard to make, apparently for our council. The one they made not long ago was rather easy, because they heard the proposal. There was unanimous and warm approval around the table, and it was decided that the recipient of the White Burkitt Miller Prize, the Burkitt Miller Prize, should be Charles McDowell. I've written, and you have in your hands, a rationale for their decision. On behalf of the White Burkitt Miller Center, I take great pride in presenting our annual award for an enduring contribution to the understanding of the American presidency to Charles McDowell, Washington correspondent and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. From the early days of the Miller Center, Charlie has been a triple threat man, bringing enlightenment on the presidency to attentive audiences at Monticello, the Rotunda, and Faulkner House, I might say on a pro bono publica basis. On Friday evenings, as a participant on Washington Week in Review, he has transformed our living rooms into seminar rooms with carefully researched and well-balanced commentary. His columns are models of political wisdom and literary clarity. No one has followed the present electoral process with greater rigor and insight. He has the energy and imagination to anticipate the twists and turns in a drama where the unexpected becomes the norm. In a world where shadows and storm clouds obscure the sunlight, Charlie brings hope through his humor. Laughter is the beginning of prayer. Increasingly, readers turn to him as their latter-day Will Rogers. This is a subject of recurrent conversation, by the way, in Washington. Yet no comparison that excludes another quality will do. McDowell is also the Walter Lippmann of the 80s through his powers of political analysis and his ability to chronicle the playing out politically of competing moral principles. Justice Holmes wrote that some people say they admire the man of principle. I respect the man who can find his way through a maze of sometimes conflicting moral principles. Justice Holmes would have admired Charles McDowell, and so do the council, associates, and staff of the Miller Center in awarding our annual prize. No one better exemplifies the ideals underlying the Burkitt Miller Award. It's a great honor to present Charlie with a small token of our respect. Now to help him avoid any embarrassment, we will launch immediately into the conversation with Charles McDowell.
Thank you, Ken. Thank all of y'all.
That was
everything he said was extravagant and outrageous, and I liked it all. I'm proud to be in Mr. Jefferson's house, and I'm proud to be here with the Miller Center, and I'm very, very proud to have that from a good friend and a good institution. While you're full of all that pride, I think of all the political speeches I've ever heard, and I'm assured by politicians that humility will ensue. But they always say that it does, and maybe before the afternoon's out. Let me say a word first about the Miller Center. It would be in terrible bad taste to launch a great thing about Ken Thompson, which I'd be capable of, but he's written somewhere that the you know, the line about purpose is to broaden public understanding of the presidency, and everybody liked it there. And I think the Miller Center has done so. And I think I know that from my colleagues in Washington who scores have been down here and spoken and talked and learned something sitting around tables or from audiences or from each other. The published work of the Miller Center is voluminous and marvelous and useful. And if there's anybody broadening public understanding of the presidency and things like the nominating process, which is so screwed up, and presidential press conferences, which are so unsatisfactory, and so many things like that, the Miller Center has really stepped in, not with some righteous notion of how to fix it, but to inquire and come to some sensible suggestions. It is taken tremendously seriously in Washington, the Miller Center and its recommendations and the things it publishes. The Miller Center must have found that anybody's happy and willing to come. Good is being done and it's being recognized in its own time. And not many people or places can say that. Now I have to remember another line that I guess Ken wrote somewhere. He said what this great principle was to broaden public understanding, and he said that the way they were going to do that was to bring together theorists and practitioners. And the first time I ever came here, I didn't know what I was supposed to be. I guess I'm a practitioner. But there was a marvelous group around a table at Canada Assembly, some very practical reporters and some very practical politicians, and Professor Malone and others. And I talked endlessly. Ken published every raving bit of it. It's just embarrassing. I keep it under things at home. And I just must talk 40 minutes before I let anyone else at the table even get in a question. And then I didn't know what I'd said. And then they asked questions and I realized my answers were beginning to contradict each other. It just wasn't getting anywhere. And it came time to quit. And Ken made up a tradition. He said, Duma Malone usually asks the last question. I think we invented that tradition right then to get it this over with. And Mr. Malone asked a question of about 90 words. And it began, on your premise that. And then he summarized a speech that I wish I had ever made. It drew together about four threads of mine and about 10 of Mr. Jefferson's and about 10 of Mr. Malone's. And the premise of the question was a brilliant summary of something I'd been fumbling for 10 years. And then he came to the question part and I said, thank you very much. And that was it. We don't know his question, but it's the most marvelous ending to a speech I've ever seen. And I hope you will all look it up. It's like in volume one before we learn to make me speak shorter. What I thought I'd do is not talk about anything profound, talk about the last few days in American politics. Miller Center exists to talk about great sweeping things. Let's talk about the last few days. And let me go back in the presidential campaign. I guess what I'm talking about is the debates and the campaigns, as I said. I took some trouble about 2 weeks ago for another purpose to pull together a lot of polls. And I checked those polls against, well, I could check them with the White House pollster, and he said it's roughly right. And he thought the summary was about right. What I'm trying to do is merge about six polls. And the Mondale people say that the merge did it's about right. And I just thought I'd give you a snapshot of the election about 10 to 12 days ago. Not who's ahead and who's behind. As a matter of fact, Mr. Reagan was up 18 points, probably 18 to 20 points as of that day of that snapshot, the few days of these snapshots. What matters in polls isn't who's ahead and all that stuff. It's what's going on in people's heads. And that's down toward the bottom of the poll. It's very hard for my profession to sum up and make any sense of. But here's a snapshot. Who offers strong leadership? Ronald Reagan, 65 to 75%. Over 42% of the people thought Mondale offered strong leadership. So Reagan's up there, 20 to 30 points on the concept of strong leadership. And then they asked the same kinds of things a lot of ways. Who's restoring respect for America? Restoring respect for America. Reagan by 25 points. Who's inspiring confidence in the White House as an institution of leadership? Reagan by 25 points. Everything that refers to personality, Reagan won by about 30 points. Everything that applied to leadership, Reagan won by about 25 points. And then you skip to one issue, which is the only one he dominated. The others were narrow. Who can best keep the country prosperous? Reagan by 20 points. Who can best keep inflation down? Reagan by 20 to 30 points, depending on the day the poll was asked and how they phrased it. Who's making, this is a good kind of question, who's making people like me better off? Asked of a true cross-section of 1,200 multiplied by the three polls that asked that question, gives me about 3,600. That's a good random sample. Who's making people like me, they said to the random sample, better off? Reagan won that by 16 points. Now, so you have this man on personality and likability wins so big, there's no contest. On leadership, wins huge, no matter how you phrase leadership. You're touching national pride and people's real feelings for those questions. And then on the crucial issue of the economy, he wins everything by the same thing. But how about Mondale, this man who in personality wound up just sort of gray and non-existent, and leadership which just sort of got snarled at. Did he win anything? Well, I think it's interesting. Who will do best at improving things for minorities? Mondale by 25 points. Now, these are the same people that are going for Reagan at a rate of nearly 60% and have just painted the portrait of why they like him. Those same people are not deluded idiots who think, well, I'm just for Ronald Reagan. He's wonderful. He's wonderful about everything. They don't say that. They say when asked who's improving things for minorities, Mondale, 54 to 25. Who's better able to help? Who is more likely to help the poor and needy? Mondale by 60. It's 60 to 25. That's 35 points. Who is most engaged in improving the environment? Mondale by 15. Who's best able to keep us out of war? That varies on some polls. This 2-week period. Who's best able to keep us out of war? Mondale by 12. Who's willing to help women get a better break? Mondale by 30. Who's more likely to keep religion out of politics? Mondale by 24. Who's more likely to keep government policies fair? Mondale by 13. Who cares more about people like me? Mondale by 6. Who's making people like me better off? Reagan by 16. Who cares more about people like me? Mondale by 6. Now, there are no great profound meanings in all that. I mean, my first reaction to all that was that the people aren't as deluded by personality factors as I thought they were. It may be worse than that, but it's different than that. They do know something about these candidates. They paint a pretty good picture of the traditional liberal center Democrat in what they ascribe to Walter Mondale. And they're not foreign, because they're for this likable, leaderly man who has an economy that is benefiting them and they think's good for the country. What we see there is the power then, where Mr. Reagan's power lay, was personally, in leadership qualities, in the economy, and in inescapably the weakness of Mondale as a perceived personality, as a perceived leader, and indeed as the man carrying the baggage of the 50 years since Franklin Roosevelt, which we know from the long and arduous and ridiculous primary campaigns. Over half the Democrats in the primaries never voted for Mondale anyway, one wants to remember. They found fault with him. The Gary Hart phenomenon was an expression that the old politics of 50 years isn't really viable anymore, Democrats were saying. So Mondale not only had a personal problem, a leadership problem, but was branded from the primaries as the guy who just plays constituency politics. He's got labor to please and the black people to please, and he's got to give these this, and he's a protectionist because labor wants him to be, and he gives to constituencies. And in a country where not everybody was poor anymore, not even a majority were poor anymore, not even 3/4 were poor anymore, that's old politics. So you have this man in a lot of trouble, and you have this president winning this incredible landslide. And then we had a debate. And I don't mean to say, that's what I want to talk to you about, but I've got a note or two first, that the debate changed the standings, or that the debate was the beginning of the end. The debate did change the whole context of the contest in the eyes of respondents to newspaper interviews, to polls, to what you find in the circuit. The circuit is of the television era, and the circuit is the input of the debate. There are these people debating, talking. It gets in a circuit. Here come the commentators telling you what they thought it meant. Here come the spokesman for the candidates putting into that circuit what they don't like about what the commentator said. Here come the polls into the circuit. And this whole thing is just going around. And then people who said the first night they thought Reagan did quite well, they've been in watching the circuit and they've decided he didn't do near that well. And that happens in all kinds of ways. And if enough of them say, yeah, Mondale did really good, the circuit says, yeah, he really did do good. And there's a lot going on at once that you don't want to worry about. But it seems to me some very fundamental things probably happened in television politics. And I do not propose to you that television politics is some kind of fake politics, hokey politics. It's the politics we got. And it's played in a medium called television. And the effort to use ads on television to manipulate the public on television isn't very effective. What's effective on television is when you truly engage people's heads and hearts as a debate does, and you really engage them and they see everything for the first time again, is how I guess I would put it. The effect of the debate. The debate introduced the age issue into the presidential campaign. That's what it did. The most important thing it did. This is the oldest president we've ever had. He's a phenomenon. Everyone that knows him knows he's vigorous and all those things. And the age issue, he's been able to bypass, and he didn't have to work very hard at it. He joked a little bit about it and hadn't had to worry about it. He's 73 years old, and suddenly every American has a sense that, well, you know, at 73, he seems maybe just a tad wobbly. Now, that may not be true. Maybe he wasn't a tad wobbly. Maybe he was just overloaded with information and they were making him not be Reagan and he shouldn't have listened to him. We'll see. But suddenly the thing we've all avoided, you couldn't write successfully about it because nobody cared, we have an age issue. And it's valid to the degree that the man is older than other presidents have ever been. And the issue now sits there. It is a tremendous vulnerability, it would seem to me, in the whole leadership thing. It begins to make you worry about the leadership factor. It doesn't, it seems to me, bother the personal popularity factor. And we'll now begin to see which is which, and are they different, and how do people feel. The second thing the debate did, besides introduce the whole notion of Mr. Reagan being older and maybe not so sure anymore and maybe not so able to keep things straight, it strengthened Walter Mondale personally, where he'd been the weakest. It strengthened him tremendously, it seems to me. All this is just the most opinion you ever heard in your life. I don't think it's measurable in so he'll gain 9 points. As a matter of fact, the polls seem to show he's gained about 3 points. If the spread was 18 to 20, that's much bigger than any Republican ought to be over any Democrat ever. This election's always been supposed to get closer. George Gallup draws a marvelous chart where the lines always get closer. It's a matter of how much closer. They never go away from each other. They tend to come in, given you don't have some huge event. Walter Mondale's much stronger. That doesn't mean he's going to get a lot more votes, but he's much stronger. The situation now exists in which he can begin to override his own image as dull and sour and gripey and negative and mean and small-minded. Most people didn't see that on their television set. They were shocked. In an hour and a half, they saw a man that wasn't those things. It wasn't an excerpt from this, and it wasn't a little piece in some column. It was a whole hour and a half to look. And to an astonishing number of people, huge numbers, he came through as positive and much more likable than I thought, much more this than I thought, much more everything than people thought. pretty good candidates, I came out, when you go around and ask people about it. He began to override some of the negative baggage picked up in that long Democratic campaign. Some of it, because he seemed to be a person, you just didn't see the baggage in the debate. If Mr. Reagan had debated differently, perhaps he could have hung some of that baggage back on him. I think the really crucial matter is, in terms of tactics, that the debate apparently did not change people's perception of the economy issue. And if most people are better off, and if most people are willing or eager to close their minds to the implications of deficits or to have some positive view about continued expansion and all, if they want to count on how they're doing well, and this debate didn't shake that. And it has been the view of everybody. You've got to shake Reagan personally and as a leader, and the economy's got to shake to turn a president out of office. Americans don't turn presidents out of office, except in, you've got to have a lot going on. I don't think we're necessarily on the way to a reevaluation of Ronald Reagan. I just say for the first time the situation is such that it could happen. For that reevaluation to result in his defeat seems immensely unlikely to me. But I mean, you'd have to really go downhill and some really bad things would have to happen, huge bad things. I think it's made Mondale a credible candidate, and I want to talk about that for a minute and then I want to go away. That lifts the spirit of, that lifts the spirit and the energy of Democrats. You don't have to add a point for people to get some energy and some pride. I don't know if you noticed it, but you couldn't find Mondale Ferraro stickers in Northern Virginia where I live. And Monday morning, you could. People went and got them, stuck them on the car. They had them in the house. They suddenly weren't embarrassed. Walter Mondale, I don't think we did it to him, but the media, news media and himself and the whole whatever's going on in that circuit had made him an almost truly embarrassing candidate for president. After the debate, he wasn't an embarrassing candidate for president, and Democrats came to life. That will help people running for Congress. It will help people running for the Senate. It will energize Democratic workers to get back down, make some phone calls and do some things, and it will have an effect in politics. I will end on a noble note here, and then I hope you'll ask questions. When Mondale became a credible candidate, assuming that Reagan has been one and remains one, it made possible some attention to the problems of this country and to the issues. As long as it's lopsided and crazy, nothing gets discussed. The president doesn't discuss the future at all. Mr. Mondale is hung up with the politics of the past and has trouble getting to the future, and we haven't had anything approaching a debate and discussion of the problems of this country and the prospects of this country. Mondale doesn't have to close the gap with the president. Mondale just has to be credible so people will listen to him, for the president to begin to have to reply. And I would say the debate, so-called, improved the feel and mood of our politics immensely, and the deepest Reagan voter ought to try to concede that it was good for this country and good for our politics to get a candidate out of the cartoon stage that Mondale was in and make him credible and reasonable and worth listening to. And that's all that I suggest is important, and it seems to me that's tremendously important. The dialogue of an election is to me as important as the outcome. And if we're going to all just deal with outcomes and things, we can follow baseball and football and play tennis. An election does two things. It elects a leadership, but it brings into perspective for us what we're about. What are we trying to do? What are our problems? And when issues begin to come into focus, we begin to get the other benefit of an election, some serious thought given by real people to the country's problems. And I think in that sense, we should be just thankful that Mondale did well in the debate. And it doesn't require us to say the president did awful or semi-awful or pretty bad or whatever we think he did. I've talked too long. Thank you. Now, y'all bound to have things you'd like to talk about. I left out.
I'd like to ask the first question, or you go ahead.
Well, I was just telling them some things I left out. I didn't talk about Ms. Ferraro and George Bush, or the latest radio bulletins on those two, or any of those things. So anybody, just anything, it doesn't matter. If I don't know, I'll talk about it anyway. Yes, sir.
Was it really a debate, or was it, I got the impression of a puppet show, which had, I agree with you, excellent side effects, but to me it was no debate at all. But each person was told exactly what to say, and so on. And I'm an ex-debating coach,
yeah.
And it struck me they were just posture.
Well, I have immense, y'all heard the question, I think, just posturing, was it a debate? Were they just propped up there and saying things that they'd been told to say? I think the answer to all those things is yes, any debating coach would view it about like that if he's a serious person. I have terrific reservations about how the debates are handled and the use of the press and the debates and all those things. But I think it's pretty unreal of us to think that television is a medium for that sort of thing. With or without the press, I don't think it would have been much different. It can have been a wasted time if it was a time to change people's perceptions. If it had changed people's perceptions that Walter Mondale was, you know, everyone that knows anything about American politics may disagree with Walter Mondale, but they know he's been a very competent, careful, conscientious politician for 30 years. For him to have suddenly become a villainous poop was unreal. So to get him back into something like he is was worth whatever, it seems to me. If indeed it's wise for us to go ahead and think about Mr. Reagan's age and abilities and then go on and vote for him, I think it was worth it in that regard. I thought you saw a lot of how their minds work in that debate, not how the issues play. Television doesn't deal with issues worth a hoot and never would, and if you stand them up there and have the statement and the rejoinder and something else, it doesn't come through television very well, and the public isn't sitting there tuned to the issues. They look into people, how they work, how their heads work, how they react. I just go on and accept it's a new kind of thing. And I think as a new kind of thing, it was fairly successful. It certainly was not a debate on the 9 points versus the 8 points, and which 3 points can we agree are the crucial points, and all that wonderful logical thing. Politics never has been any good at that, and it ain't gonna get good in the age of television. That's a bad answer, I'm sorry.
Next question.
Yes.
Anybody who followed the Mondale campaign at all, in the newspaper or more personally, I think would conclude that here was a very orderly campaign identifying major issues, the deficit, arms control, and so forth down the line, and that Mondale had worked out as carefully as anyone could positions on each of these issues. But that where he was missing it was on style. And that's where, as you suggested here, that's where he would get low marks. Mm-hmm. What he had to do then in the debate, and he did successfully, it seems to me, was to demonstrate a style. He had a stylistic success in regard to what was a fairly orderly set of messages. On the other hand, here is Ronald Reagan, who is accused of being almost total style, and he packs his head full of all kinds of facts and figures and fumbles around because he can't keep them straight and so forth. My question really is, looking ahead to the next debate, isn't it entirely possible that we get a stylistic response by the actor that is the equal to, or perhaps even better than, Mondale? We don't get an issue engagement, but we get a stylistic show.
I think that's quite possible, and I really think a lot of the things you said in the question we ought to just to sort of adopt as a resolution. You know, you're right, in my opinion, about most of that, and I think it's important. Let's see where it starts, because I have some feelings. First of all, let me just take a trivial point. The issues aren't, whether they get debated or not, doesn't really depend in the end on whether Mondale and Reagan stand there and say them to each other. People are listening today to what all the candidates are saying, including the candidates for the Senate in Utah, because of the debate Sunday night. suddenly America was sort of drawn into one of those Marshall McLuhan village things where people are interested now in some things that will improve the quality of debate in a House of Delegates race in Texas. Okay, so yes, it would be nice if the next debate now really focused on foreign affairs issues, and as you would lay out, we have a fairly good prospect that Reagan will come back all style, which leads me to say I want to talk about style for a minute. Walter Mondale, incidentally, an earlier question suggested that they, and maybe yours, maybe some things I said, that they're just all stuffed full of things, and they just have all these hammers just pouring things over them, and they're just people along a string out there. They are two of the stubbornest men in politics. That one of the many untold stories about Ronald Reagan is how poorly he takes direction. They have an awful time telling him what to do in the White House. Just a really hard time. They write him drafts of speeches. He says, I don't like it. They write him some more drafts. He lays them all out on the desk and writes this little piddly stuff with his own hand and goes out with the 4x5 cards. And it's become a one-line joke in America. Well, if he hadn't got his 4x5 cards, he doesn't know what to say. Hell, he wrote the 4x5 card. I mean, people don't understand his strengths and weaknesses and how tangled up they are. Ronald Reagan thinks for himself and probably says more things he evolved than any president in my time. We have these nice notions of how these people are. Ronald Reagan did not go out there stuffed full of stuff until he took the advice. Something in him told him, I've been getting away without knowing the facts here too. And I better go on and accede to Jim Baker and Jim Baker's assistant's notion that they better load me up and we'll give people one fast shot here that I can do this. He's a very fast study, and I don't mean to get into the theatrical language because I don't even agree with the notion that he's the standard actor. But he is a fast study and can learn things fast and same. Style. The old McDowell song that everyone's tired of. Most of my colleagues just hold their ears when I start because they don't even agree with me, let alone want to hear it again. Ronald Reagan is the least actor that's been in the presidency in my lifetime. Ronald Reagan is the perfect example of a man who is himself. If you learn that through the Stanislavski method, it doesn't show up in the biographies of him. I doubt it. He probably did learn around movie sets and in radio stations some things about the voice and some things about, he might even learn the movie set what they teach. Not very good actors. Well, if you don't know how to act mad, think mad. Reach into yourself and find how it is to be mad and do it. That's Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan is Ronald Reagan is Ronald Reagan. To see him as an actor gives us, it seems to me, some truth, but a lot of bad perceptions. He is who he is who he is. He never fools you. He just is. And Walter Mondale required, up until just last weekend, to figure out what his style was. And lo and behold, he decided, I'm in so much trouble, I've taken everybody's advice, I've been 9 times a Mondale, I was good old Mondale, and I was fighting Fritz Mondale, and I was the protectionist Mondale against Harden, and now I'm this other kind of Mondale. He decided, I'll just be. And the Walter Mondale that walked out on that stage in Louisville, Kentucky, was the one his neighbors know, and the ones his colleagues in the Senate have long known. And they were delighted and startled to find. And his Republican friends were dismayed to find. And he had a lot of Republican friends. But he's that fellow you saw there. That's him. He threw out all the junk and came on, and we call it style. It was a guy finally being himself. We had one guy being himself who's long, for 30 years, had a command of the detail and the philosophy and the thrust of American government. We have Reagan, who has revolutionized politics by being himself and has never had that kind of command of those things, but has not missed the point very often and has caught the thrust of what the American people want, who threw probably a fairly bad decision and feeling a little wobbly that night, didn't do his Ronald Reagan thing very well. He let Mondale make his clothes, and he made Mondale's, and you know, they kind of got mixed up. But let's don't get carried away with, I suggest we don't get carried away with the word style. Remember that the word truth who are they really is not far removed from what we're calling style. And I think that's very important.
Yes. You said the debate last night changed anything in any way?
The debate last night between Ms. Ferraro and Bush, let's see. Think of how it could have been different. If Bush had been terrible, and I mean, it seems to me we've got to see it entirely in terms of the presidential race, how people see vice president. If Bush had been terrible and people had linked it, Lord, the president was terrible, now Bush is terrible, and the president looked old and wobbly, suppose he couldn't finish his term, we got this guy. Then it all begins to hook up. That would be an event. If he had made Mrs. Ferraro look like a fool, which most people don't seem to think he did, that would have been an event. If she'd made a fool of herself, or if she had somehow just outwitted him at every turn, that would have been an event. As it was, the polls show that most people, that Bush has a margin. It varies from about 10 to 25 or so. So Bush did better, but when you ask more questions, no, she didn't do bad. There seems to be no strong feeling. If you ask people what they remember out of the debate, they remember her saying, "Don't patronize me." And every woman remembers it. And they remember her reaction with Shane, which she's done on the stump many times, and he happened to play right to that. He suggested, she said, the Veru boys died in Shane, and she doesn't take that. She's a sharp, tough lady, and that flash came, and people remember that. The clip that television has played over and over is one of those. And after we've seen that clip for 3 or 4 days, it's in the circuit, and the debate kind of gets to be the time Geraldine Ferraro told George Bush, "Don't you patronize me," and something about Beirut. So I don't think it probably had a profound effect. We ought to acknowledge that if people were saying by some rate over 50%, let's remember over 50% of the people planned to vote for Reagan and Bush, so it isn't highly unusual that over 50% of them thought Bush did pretty well. The interesting is how few thought the president did well, we're going to vote for him. I think people who are a little worried about Republicans, or shaky Republicans, whoever they might be, who are worried about the president's age and health, might have been reassured by the Bush debate. But it's all in little tolerances and didn't seem to me to be a big deal. Yes.
A reverse question. They're having trouble getting reporters to ask the questions. What does that say about what the politicians are thinking of the national media?
Well, what they're having trouble doing is accepting reporters recommended to them. As of now, that seems to be the principal trouble. There were somewhere between 112 and 140 names submitted to the two candidates, and they couldn't find but about 8 that they thought they would like to be questioned by. There's some question in the world whether it's an honor to have been one of the 8 that they felt was dumb enough to ask questions. It seems to me that, incidentally, they wound up with 2 good panels, so I'm not too worried about it. And I'm not very worried if a member of the press asks a long question or that's not our work. I don't think we ought to have been there. I think there ought to have been a moderator there, and those people ought to be going at each other. But nevertheless, I'm glad it occurred. What does it say about the politicians and the national press? The politicians and the national press are adversary, and long have been. Adversary in a friendly way, as a rule. It's hard to be out there and be reading press reports of everything bad that happened to you yesterday. And no, we're not terribly interested in writing about just what a good fella you were all day long. We're just not that interested. We're looking for some news and something that would affect people. So they don't love the press. Before, in past years, in situations of this type, and there have been other types since 1960, both sides have approved nearly everyone submitted and have sort of agreed the press has, made us mad last week, but they're fair-minded. David Roeder will be fair, Hayes Johnson will be fair, Steve Wiseman will be, just the well-known reporters will be. So will most reporters be fair. This is a little new that each side is querulous. Angry. I think a good many of Mr. Reagan's advisors, don't think the press is. I mean, they've had the best press of any president since Roosevelt, and they don't think we treat them fairly. And they feel that strongly, and they'll strike people who they say he's a secret liberal, she's one of those nuts and all. Now, the Mondale people were so far down, they felt beat up by the press. They really felt beat up by the press, and they were really angry at the negative stories. They couldn't get out from under negative stories. They didn't stop and do the self-examination, you know, that would say we've given them a lot of negative stories. They were mad, and they struck a bunch of names. And so we just came out with very few. I predict that sort of sobered everybody, and that won't happen anymore. But I hope there'll never be another one where the press has to ask the questions. I still think it ought to be let the candidates ask the questions of each other, and some moderator kind of moving from subject to subject, urging them to finish up. Seems to me distracting, and I don't like the context of the panel show, because it seems to me to create subliminally another game show. Don't take it too seriously. And somebody to blame. Look at those people asking the President of the United States that rude question. I think they are. Well, why do people, we don't want them thinking about that. I like them thinking about what's being said. I don't think I answered your question, but we've raved about it. Yes?
After Barbara Bush's characterization of Mrs. Ferraro a couple of days ago, and then George Bush's comments today, I get this sort of sense that they, as Connecticut patricians, are just scared to death of this Italian immigrant coming in, and the fact of the matter is that a huge majority of the country is not Connecticut patrician, and is liable to resent, particularly Barbara Bush's comments, but even George Bush's comments today. I don't think most people, even Republican supporters, would agree with Bush's characterization of what he kicked last night. How do you sense that going down with voters?
Well, before I do that, I'm trained in the news. I think we better tell people what we're talking about. Everybody remembers that Mrs. Bush, who has a reputation for being a truly charming and witty and alert bright lady, did in an off moment call Mrs. Ferraro that blank rhymes with rich. And then later, and I thought probably the worst apology ever offered, said she would never have called her a witch. Either that was very inept or a moment of great mean-mindedness. The Vice President of the United States said today on a dock somewhere, and I'm not clear whether the mic was supposed to be open or closed, and it's a phrase, as he later explained from this playing field, so we can say it in his house, I think. He said, well, we kicked a little ass last night. That is a sports term that is used in any football locker room if you really got them in the first game. It's not thought of as a terrible thing. It's not meant sexist. But his system wasn't working fast enough to tell him. One, it was a bad idea to say it. Two, it was braggy. And three, and most important, she's a woman. And good Lord, and all of a sudden you're into real trouble. Which brings us to the question. I don't, you know, about the time you lay down rules about who the American people won't elect, you get the patrician Franklin Roosevelt, you know, and you get, well, we're not going to elect some kind of a Boston fellow like Kennedy, and yeah, we did that. And it's a popularity contest, and the American people will always now going to want these jolly, good, handsome fellows, and they elect Nixon. You know, you just can't be sure about any of these things. It has long been imagined that if George Bush, and incidentally Barbara Bush, who in the age of television becomes part of the persona, that they had a preppy image. Everyone says preppy. I talked to an old Taft guy in San Francisco who's a great friend of George Bush. And he said, the right wing leave him alive. George is a cucumber sandwich. Well, I've never thought about that, but it comes out of everybody. He's a cucumber sandwich, or whatever they think. He's a tough, resourceful guy, but he has that quality. He's preppy. He's whatever. Now, these are preppy remarks. They're the wife of a preppy, that blank who rhymes with rich. That, and George saying, what an uncharacteristic thing for the Yale George to say we kicked a little ass. I mean, what I resent is him saying it at all. You know, as if he was was some big deal. So I don't know where it goes, but now we'll cite what seems to be important. The articulate populists in America are very conservative Republicans. If there's a populist movement in the new way we mean populist, we just everybody. They are at war with George Bush, and central to their war with him is the preppy image, and second, the feeling that he's a secret Dewey Republican, which is preposterous, but they think it's true. But if you go to Dick Vigory or these people from NCPAC and the Jerry Falwell, the rising union of the populist conservative and the charismatic preachers, George Bush is target number one for those people. And Jack Kemp's stalking of him, or Newt Gingrich's, or Ben Weber's, or somebody that's going to get George Bush, is what the next 4 years of the Republican administration are going to be about politically, is how they bring down George Bush. And what motivates them in their soul is your question about, is he too preppy, too aristocratic, too all those things. In the very back.
Do you think President Reagan could have gotten there with refusing to debate?
The question is, could the president have gotten away with refusing to debate? Mondale said on the air that he thought he could have. I think he could have got away with refusing and still been elected, because I think his margin has been, and is tonight, so immense. But Ronald Reagan could never live with Ronald Reagan without debating, and Ronald Reagan is who he is, who he is. I'll stand right there. Of course Ronald Reagan was going to debate. Not because he's a particularly macho type man, from my reading of him, which I spent a lot of time thinking about, not much time having any real close experience with. I don't figure him as a man with bravado and I can beat anybody debating. I think Ronald Reagan thinks a candidate for president ought to debate, ought to be willing to debate and minimize the exposure and get it over with, but I think Mr. Reagan thinks that people deserve that, he ought to do it. He has done well in debates, and he had no reason to think he would be terribly damaged in a debate. He's been a very resourceful TV debater. I don't think in one of your kind of debates, unless you chose the subjects very carefully, he would last very long. But he does okay in the television exchange. Yes, sir?
Is part of the attack on George Bush as a preppy American prejudice that I've run into, that any man in the street can do any job in the government that no particular qualifications are required.
Mm-hmm. We have that streak. We care on all the time about plain people, and we elect plain people to office. We have a pretty heavy I don't think you'd find too many of these plain people in this century in our politics, but we found Cal Coolidge somewhere, and you know, we talk a bigger game of that than we hold people to. But if you're gonna be a preppy, think of Franklin Roosevelt, the cigarette holder and the damnedest accent you ever heard, and a certain arrogance. Everybody voted for him, and which people were they? The plain people. But if you're going to have one of these unusual, non-plain people images, you've got to show people something real behind your manner. We're very easily prejudiced about manner.
In other words, you're getting at the real criticism of George Bush, that he is lacks leadership, but he's...
That would be where the problem is. Yes. Now you're getting to the problem. That's where the problem is. He has not overcome that. He is our most experienced government servant. Most Democrats rate him very well in the jobs and stuff. But he had a real hard time getting elected in Texas. And he's not a great elected politician yet. Then we cast him in this role of vice president, where you have to say, yes, sir, I just believe in everything the president says, yes, sir. And we don't know quite how to work that office.
Ken's going to solve it. With 20 seminars, we're going to get the vice presidency straight. But right now, we haven't gotten it straight. An impossible position to serve in, where you have to be. George Bush slipped two disagreements with Reagan into that debate, if you listen very carefully. He slipped them in and then said, it doesn't matter, I'm with him. But he slipped them in. He slid his abortion difference in, and he slid one other one. But we talk a bigger game about the plain people than we play. The plain people will vote for any fancy man who shows them something they like, leadership quality, as you put it. Yes?
It strikes me that on October 7th, Sunday night, Walter Mondale finally won the nomination for the Democratic Party.
I like that.
After a very long struggle, much longer even than I thought. What, at least up until then, Ferraro had been consistently upstaging him, either positively, because this was the first woman candidate, or negatively, and here she was constantly through the abortion issue or the financial thing, getting the headline. Mm-hmm. My question really is, does that mean any difference on the, will that cause any changes in the Democratic campaign from this point on? Because she strikes me, she's now in a little different position than she has been.
Well, I think it will. Normally, the vice presidential candidates, of course, we've never had, this ain't normal. But up to now, vice presidential candidates begin to recede in October and disappear by mid-October. How we do it. But we have this remarkable thing of this woman. And now she's beginning to grow on people as a specific woman. People who are traveling the campaign are finding just crowds coming out with little chants that show they've been reading how she talks and how she acts. A lot of attention to her Queen's accent that's positive, and people are yelling at her in her accent. And there's something going on with Geraldine Ferraro. And there's something going on with women in America and Geraldine Ferraro and something, and for all I know. But I think you said it better than that. You serve as my doom I'm alone here. Walter Mondale won the nomination. I adopt that. And of course it changes things for the Democrats. It makes Democrats able to talk to each other. Talk to candidates. You don't want to talk to each other about politics if you're both embarrassed about your candidate and he's getting slaughtered. And you're going to sit there over a beer or something and say, gee, he's doing terrible. And no one's going to say, he's just awful. Why does he do it? Once you get a little proud of him, you begin to say, now if he'll do so-and-so, we can do this, and let's get out of mailing and try to help the congressman. Sure, changes, makes the Democratic Party seem viable and reasonable. It doesn't lift a great deal of the burden of the old politics off their back, which people perceive. And as long as the economics seem to be coming to a summary, I'm not really going to do that. As long as the economy is this good and Mr. Reagan is standing erect, walking and talking, what we're talking about here is improving the Democratic mood and feel and support troops and getting it ready for the future, I would think. What do you want to do, Ken?
One more question.
I got it.
Polls indicate that the 1824 enthusiasm for Reagan. Mm-hmm. You think that real can stick, and will they vote?
18-24-year-olds are majority for Reagan in the polls, and no, they don't vote at a predictable rate. They don't vote, and there won't be any great surprises about whether they vote. They'll vote at about half the rate of people 40 to 55 or something, and they won't surprise us. I absolutely trust Curtis Gans and his, whatever it is, Bureau of Voting Statistics. He'll tell you exactly how many of them will vote. He can't tell you how they're going to vote, but he knows they're going to vote. They'll vote at their usual low rate, and they apparently, according to public opinion polls, will lean toward Reagan, and I wouldn't expect that to change radically. That generation doesn't know anything before World War II, and turns out not to know very much about Vietnam or events that recent. It has had no experience of the New Deal, of Depression. It's had no experience of the labor movement in America. It's had no experience of a time when most people were poor. It lacks all kinds of experience, and it has, when they really pushed, again, I keep referring to polls, they talk about opportunity.
And young people, 18 to 24, in that range are worried about getting a job. And they're interested in opportunity, and the opportunity they can visualize working is an expansion of the economy. They don't come to that very articulately, but they get to it. And the Democrats, they don't know exactly how the Democrats plan to make them have opportunity. The Democrats are worried about, seem worried most, about black youth and what to do with labor that's being phased out of jobs by Japanese imports, and what to do about people on Indian reservations, and what to do about Hispanics. And middle class, 18 to 24 year old kids who haven't been in touch with much history and haven't been in touch with any philosophy about politics are looking, amazingly enough, I mean, for a person of my age, at the Republican Party as a party of opportunity for young people. They want to expand the economy, and maybe we can get a job. It's hard to get a job. And Democrats who've looked into that and really thought about it think it's a very, very serious thing they have to contend with, how they let the notion of the party of opportunity get away from them. And they see that it's not illogical. That many young people are thinking that way. They want to get a job and work, and everybody's well off. They ought to be well off. And the Democratic message has been so muted due to Mondale's troubles that I don't think they've heard the compassion argument, the responsibility argument, all the arguments that should be brought to bear. I think I have again over-talked in Charlottesville. I swear, I got a new title for